I've already had a couple requests and suggestions for you guys to go on the road with these presentations. I'll get a 10% handling fee, I think. But some of the big hospitals in the area would love to have you come and present to other clinicians. This was mentioned about one of the presentations yesterday and the presentation this morning already. So I will field all those. They don't usually pay you, but it's more exposure. They might be able to pay you with a job. You know, you could hold out and not do it unless they were going to offer you a job, something like that. But I do think that these should be shown as often as to as many people as possible. They're just wonderful examples. So we next have Team Dizzy coming up. Team Vertigo, sorry, the technical term, Team Vertigo. And this is a very interesting topic that has morphed over the last year considerably. And this group will be talking about a very important intervention, vestibular rehab, as well as CBT, in the treatment of chronic dizziness. Any of you that have experienced, well, I know a lot of you have experienced acute dizziness after too much life at the pub, but dizziness is a serious malady, and so I really look forward to this. And their supervisor was Dr. Janice Eng. So take it away.
Good morning. I'd like to start our presentation today by thanking our colleagues in the community who have taken time out of their busy day to come and share in some of the work we've been doing at UBC. I'd also like to thank my fellow MPT students for amazing presentations, and to thank you in advance for not falling asleep during ours. Okay, our research team, which consists of Brian Cervantes, April Pemble, Erica Haker, Shyla Jiwa, and myself, Rhonda Cooper, worked under the supervision of Janice Ng, who's back there, to examine the effectiveness of cognitive behavioral therapy and vestibular rehabilitation in adults suffering from chronic dizziness. So here is a brief outline of today's presentation. I will be giving you an introduction to our subject, and then Brian will take you through the methods that we used, and April will give a presentation on the results and discussion. And then Erica will give you a presentation that is really quite fascinating, I think, on the physiology of the vestibular system and how that relates to our experience of dizziness and anxiety. And then Shyla will take you through limitations of the studies that we used, limitations of our own review, future research, and a summary, otherwise known as the take-home message. So before I address the importance of identifying the most effective interventions for this patient population, I'd just like to talk a little bit about the interventions that we examined. So does anybody here work in vestibular rehabilitation or use vestibular rehab in their practice? Okay, nobody who's willing to fess up. Does anybody here suffer from chronic dizziness? Yes, Jessica. Okay, so I'm going to take you through an exercise that might be helpful for reducing that chronic dizziness. Okay, so this is just an example of one exercise that might be used sort of in initial treatment for helping with gaze stability. So if you'd just like to focus on the image on the screen, and keeping your eyes focused on the image, just turn your head from left to right. And just do that a few times. And you can increase the tempo if it's not making you feel at all nauseous. And then try just nodding your head up and down, keeping focused on the image again. And then if that was okay, if you'd like to stand up, just, it gives you a chance to stretch your legs. It's all good. And then just repeat the same thing. And so just turning your head left to right, eyes focused on the image, and up and down. Okay, so you can sit down. So likely that was very easy for everybody here. Likely you didn't feel dizzy, you didn't lose your balance. But for somebody with chronic dizziness, this would cause them to lose their balance. Okay, so I just want you to spend a moment thinking about how you might feel that if every time you moved your head quickly, you lost your balance or felt nauseous. Does anyone want to share what they're thinking? Okay, well, I'll share with you what we thought. We thought that if every time we turned our head quickly or our eyes were moving in opposition to where our head was moving, we lost our balance, we might feel anxious and we might feel unsafe. And we might limit some of our social involvement, because if you went to a party or a picnic, maybe a business party or a business picnic, and every time you turned quickly, you sort of lost your balance, or if there was lots of stuff going on, you were kind of ataxic gait, there might be some misinterpretation that maybe you'd been drinking too much or something like that. So we thought in situations, social situations, or in situations that required good balance for safety, you might feel anxious. And we went so far as to consider that chronic dizziness might be inextricably linked to chronic anxiety. Similar to the idea of chronic pain that we deal with now, where chronic pain is inextricably linked to an emotional sort of subset. So does anybody here work in cognitive behavioral therapy? No? We were hoping somebody would give us a definition. But what we found for the treatment of anxiety, cognitive behavioral therapy uses a strategy of accommodation, or let's see if I can find the proper word here for it. Habituation, thank you, Eric. It uses a strategy of habituation. So it usually occurs one-on-one. So say a client was got anxious in open spaces, agoraphobia. You would take that client into increasingly more and more open spaces as they were able to accommodate and adjust to feeling comfortable in those situations. And vestibular rehab is somewhat similar. It does use habituation as well. The difference is that you're exposing the client to stimuli that bring on dizziness. So you might start with just head motions, where they would very similar to the very first ones we did, and then moving the head and eye in opposition, and then adding external stimulus that would also confuse the vestibular system, and slowly you're training the vestibular system to accommodate to these situations. For our systematic review, we excluded studies that used exclusively cantilith positioning maneuvers because there had already been a systematic review done on this. One of our studies does use a administered cantilith repositioning maneuver, but it's done in conjunction with vestibular exercises. All right, so the reason why we felt that it was important to get the most effective interventions in this area is that chronic dizziness affects a large percentage of the older adult population. Roughly 1/3 of older adults experience dizziness or loss of equilibrium. However, chronic dizziness is not limited to an older adult population. 1 in 5 working age adults report experiencing dizziness, and 1 in 10 report experiencing dizziness as a handicap. This in turn affects gainful employment and subsequently the economy. The prevalence of dizziness may be underestimated, as many people living in community have handicapping chronic dizziness that is neither diagnosed nor treated. Quality of life is an issue for those who suffer from chronic dizziness. For the elderly population, chronic dizziness is a serious problem because it causes fear of falling, and we know that fear of falling precipitates falls. And in an elderly population, falling might lead to a fracture of the hip, which in the worst case scenario can hasten mortality. In all populations, chronic dizziness can lead to musculoskeletal problems such as neck stiffness and headache, as well as limit social activities. Limited social involvement may lead to increased anxiety and increased depression. Anxiety and dizziness are comorbid conditions in a larger percentage of patients than would be expected from chance, which suggests a possible connection between vestibular dysfunction and anxiety disorders. Many patients with anxiety disorders present with abnormal vestibular function, and conversely, many patients with vestibular disorders suffer from anxiety. I think it's important to recognize that patients with chronic dizziness may experience anxiety and depression, and thus may require additional treatment of these psychological issues. Cognitive behavioral therapy, which we'll call CBT for short, has been successfully implemented in the treatment of anxiety and depression. Vestibular rehabilitation, which we'll refer to as VR for short, has been used as an effective treatment for dizzy patients regardless of the mechanism of complaint. Therefore, it seems logical to combine VR and CBT to attempt to achieve a greater treatment effect than would be possible through the use of VR alone. Erica will expand on this idea through the physiological connections between dizziness and anxiety that serve to strengthen this idea during the discussion portion of the presentation. Currently, there are no systematic reviews exploring the use of VR and CBT. Therefore, the purpose of this systematic review is to examine the effectiveness of CBT used in conjunction with VR for the treatment of chronic dizziness in the adult population. I will now hand it over to Brian to take you through the methods.
Thank you, Rhonda. For our literature search, we performed a comprehensive electronic search that encompassed 10 electronic databases, CINAHL, the two Cochrane databases, ACP Journal, Club of EBM Reviews, Embase, Google Scholar, Pedro, PsycINFO, and PubMed and Web of Science. Our searches on PubMed and Web of Science were performed slightly different than the rest, so I will discuss those details later on. We also wanted to look at the unpublished literature, so we looked at papers first and ProQuest dissertations and theses. The key words we looked at were a combination of three elements. The first element was vestibular rehabilitation, but we also used variations of this, such as exercise therapy, and kinesiotherapy. The second element was cognitive behavioral therapy, and in addition, we used cognitive therapy, behavioral therapy, and psychotherapy. And the last element that we were looking at was dizziness, or vestibular disease, vestibular disorder, balance disorder, and vertigo. Now, when it came to our limits, we only included English, as we did not have the resources to expand on other languages. In addition, we stopped our literature search up to June 2006. Now, with regards to the type of study, we decided to consider any type of study, but we did not include reviews in our paper. The reasons we imposed no limits on the study design was that this topic is quite specific, and we thought it would be important to include all the relevant articles that are out there. Now, I just want to talk about how we did PubMed, since it was a little different. Our searches on PubMed were, our initial search using the keywords resulted in 783 articles. So as our good friend Nick would say, that's just too big. And therefore, we used the clinical queries filter to limit to randomized controlled trials, which narrowed things down to 99, so that's a manageable number. From this point, we then use the relevant articles link on identified articles of interest, which is a feature that does not limit studies based on study design. Other strategies that we used included Web of Science. At this point, we had found several articles related to our topic, and we wanted to see if there's anything else out there. Therefore, we used the author search strategy using the four primary authors of our identified relevant articles. This included Yardley, Anderson, Johansson, and Holmberg. And in addition to electronic searches, we also examined the reference list of the primary articles that we included in our study. With regards to hand searching, we analyzed a comprehensive list of journals that would likely cover our topic. And with the services of a very helpful UBC research librarian, we determined that all of the relevant journals were checked electronically. Given this and that our topic is relatively specific, we determined that we would not perform a hand search. Now, during the initial search, the titles and abstracts of articles were screened for the following inclusion criteria. One, looking at population, adults over 19 years of age with chronic dizziness. Two, looking at intervention, vestibular rehabilitation combined with cognitive behavioral therapy. And three, looking at outcome, and any relevant measures for dizziness, anxiety, and depression were considered. So things such as the dizziness handicap inventory and the vertigo symptom scale are two of the things that we had looked at, but not limited to those two. Now, we also read the full text of the articles if the titles or abstracts did not clearly indicate whether the study met the inclusion criteria. Any uncertainties were resolved by consensus among the reviewers. Now, for our quality assessment, we used a modified version of the Downs and Black checklist for measuring study quality. This checklist examines reporting, external validity, internal validity, and power, and they are scored out of a total of 32. One of the features that made this quality assessment applicable to our systematic review is that it can be applied to randomized and non-randomized studies. Now, please remember that we decided to consider any type of study for our systematic review. The quality assessment was then performed by two reviewers independently, and a disagreement process was set in place. Disagreement resolution process was set in place if any disagreements arose. The two reviewers would first discuss the issue and come up with a consensus. Otherwise, there was a third reviewer available for mediation if required. Now, the data from the selected articles was extracted using a modified tool from the Cochrane NAC review group. Again, a disagreement process was set in place, as was discussed just earlier. Now, at this point, I'd like to give the floor over to April, who will talk about our results and our discussion. Thank you.
Thanks, Brian. Okay, so like Brian said, I'm going to go over the results and the discussion. So what we did, we found 319 studies through the Electrona databases, but we also found one through searching the reference lists. From there, we got six were selected for screening, and well, after that, you're kind of guessing why we'd exclude more than that, but we did. We took out one because it didn't meet the inclusion or exclusion criteria, and then we managed to drop one more. After doing a quality assessment and data extraction, and we dropped this one because it was a single subject case report, and it scored a 3 out of 32 on our quality assessment, and we just figured that's not good enough. We came to a consensus. So I'm going to go through the articles, all four of them, but I won't be getting into too many of the outcome measures because there was 15 different outcome measures through the four studies, so I prefer if your snoring didn't interrupt my presentation. So Anderson et al., a controlled trial of CBT combined with VR in the treatment of dizziness. So this was a prospective RCT. He had 29 subjects, quality assessment score of 21 out of 32. And he compared VR and CBT to a weightless control. So for his intervention, there was 5 sessions over 7 weeks. The VR involved was Cawthorne-Cooksey exercises. And basically, they're basic vestibular rehab exercises. You start with, laying down, head in one place, and you start with just eye movements, up and down, side to side, that sort of thing. And then you progress to head nodding and that sort of thing. And you can, different speeds, that sort of thing. Very similar to what Rhonda went through. And you can progress this to harder and harder from like lying to sitting to standing to walking and then throwing ball around, that sort of thing. The CBT was relaxation exercises and then graduated exposure program. They also included an educational component, just of basic anatomy and function of the vestibular system, just knowing their pathology and what's involved and that sort of thing. So the results, basically it showed improvements in self-reported handicap, behavioral measures of exposure to dizziness-provoking movements, and then there was less distress associated with unsteadiness. There was no significant changes found in self-reported measures of general distress. Okay, so Johansson, he did a randomized controlled trial of VR combined with CBT for dizziness. This was also a prospective RCT. There's 19 subjects, the quality score of 20 out of 32. And like Anderson, he compared VR and CBT to a weightless control. And essentially, he did the same intervention. It was very, very, very similar. The results for this study showed improvements were found in the treatment group for walking time, 2 dizziness provoking movements, and also the dizziness handicap inventory, which addresses the patient's perceived ability and handicap. No significance was found on the Romberg, several of the dizziness provoking movements, or on the questionnaire measuring anxiety and depression. Okay. So the next study, feasibility and effectiveness of providing VR for dizzy patients in the community. And this is by Yardley et al., 1998. This was a prospective cohort study. There were 16 subjects. It scored a 13 out of 32 on the quality score. and it compared pre-VR and CBT to post-VR and CBT. This intervention was very, once again, really similar to the Anderson and Johansson, but the Anderson and Johansson actually based their interventions on the Yardley's intervention. The only difference is Yardley had 5 sessions over 10 weeks instead of 7 weeks, and Yardley also included the Brandt's repositioning exercises, which are similar to the Catalyst repositioning maneuvers, but except it's not a physio doing the maneuvers on the patient, it's the patient going home and doing exercises that involves just them doing the maneuver on themselves, basically. The results of this study showed improvements found in patients' ability to do activities such as walking, climbing stairs, that sort of thing. And he also found a decrease in postural sway. Okay. So the treatment of phobic postural vertigo, a controlled study of CBT and self-controlled desensitization. This study was done by Johan Holmberg, or as Brian likes to call him, Yo Homie, et al. Don't forget everyone else that was involved in the study. This was a quasi-experimental design. There was 31 subjects, a quality score of 19 out of 32. And this was the only study that did a comparison of combination of VR and CBT to VR alone. The intervention, it was a bit different than the other studies. It was a self-administered VR for 15 minutes, 2 times a day. Basic same VR exercises though. And then the CBT had 8 to 12 individual psych treatments, about 45 to 60 minutes long, and they included the educational component. The results of this study, there was small improvement in vertigo severity and handicap in VR alone, in the VR alone group. There was additional effects found in the combined VR and CBT group in regards to patients' experienced handicap, anxiety, and depression. However, all the overall treatment effects obtained were not all that strong for this study, unfortunately. So just the summary of our findings. The combination of VR and CBT was found to be effective intervention for patients with chronic dizziness in the majority of the outcome measures by the 4 studies. However, we weren't able to conclude that the combined VR and CBT is more effective than VR or CBT alone, so because Holmberg was the only study that actually looked at that and it found weak, and so we couldn't make any conclusions. But now I'm going to turn it over to Erica, who is going to give you an exciting overview of the physiology.
Thanks, April. I'm going to discuss the physiological connection between the vestibular system and anxiety in just a moment, but first I'd like to start with an exercise, if that's all right. So if I could ask everyone to close your eyes, and I'd like you to imagine that you're stopped at a traffic light, you're on a hill, and you're facing up the hill. Just before the light changes, a large bus next to you starts moving forwards very slowly, giving you visual information that you interpret as your car sliding backwards down the hill. How would you react? Well, you'd likely stomp on the brake, your heart would race, and you'd feel anxious and fearful. Now, you'd quickly relax as you realize that the perceived movement was just an illusion. But this example illustrates the inherent connections between vestibular function and anxiety, and this response is almost inevitable. Now imagine if even the smallest amount of head movement evoked this kind of reaction. It's not surprising then that patients can sometimes develop learned behavioral avoidance, i.e. avoiding activities that they even think may make them feel dizzy. So now let's look at the anatomy. There are 2 important regions that I'm going to touch on. The first are the vestibular nuclei, and the second is the parabrachial nucleus. So there are 4 vestibular nuclei within the brainstem, which are indicated by the red arrow in the diagram there. And they receive their primary input from the vestibular portion of the 8th cranial nerve, which, as you all know, is responsible for vestibular balance information and auditory information. And they also receive projections from the cerebellum, the spinal cord, and the contralateral vestibular nuclei. The parabrachial nucleus network, which is the region shaded in gray on the diagram, includes regions that generate emotional, affective, and physiological manifestations of fear and anxiety. For example, it includes the amygdala and other components of the limbic system, which you know are involved in emotional processing and memory. The parabrachial nucleus, which is indicated in the red box in the gray section, is a site of convergence of information from the vestibular, the somatic or proprioceptive,
and the visceral systems in pathways that appear to be involved in avoidance conditioning, anxiety, and conditioned fear. Also noteworthy in this diagram is the nucleus tractus solitarius, or solitaria, excuse me, a region which is responsible for visceral sensory information. And if you've ever suffered from motion sickness, you'll know what type of visceral response we're talking about. So that's just a brief overview of the anatomy. It is quite complicated, but the diagram sort of shows the inherent connections between the parabrachial nucleus network and the vestibular nuclei. So just to summarize the pathology, the connections from the vestibular nuclei to the parabrachial nucleus are a direct link between the vestibular system and neural networks involved in expressing anxiety and emotions. And they could help explain why dizziness and anxiety are comorbid conditions in a larger percentage of the population than we would expect by chance, which Rhonda mentioned earlier. And they also provide some face validity for combining the treatments of VR and cognitive behavioral therapy. So now Shiloh will take us through some of the limitations and the future research.
Thank you, Erica. Limitations. To date, there haven't been enough studies which examine VR and CBT. In our literature search, only 4 passed the inclusion and exclusion criteria. Not only do we have a limited number of studies, but also the quality of the research was fair to moderate, as the mean score for the 4 studies was 18.25 out of 32 on the modified Downs and Black quality score. Also note that the Downs and Black quality score has no cutoff points or criteria that defines a low, medium, or high level study for us to go by. Factors which contributed to the low quality scores are a lack of randomization. Only 2 articles were RCTs. Having a small sample size, the number of subjects in the 4 studies ranged from 16 to 31. A lack of a control group. For example, Holmberg et al. Did not use a control group when comparing combined VR and CBT to VR alone. And lack of blinding. None of the studies were double blinded, since it would be difficult to blind the therapist performing the treatment. Another major limitation is that only 1 study compared combined VR and CBT to VR alone. So it may be possible that either VR or CBT caused most of the improvements in the combined intervention studies. Or it may also be possible that combining VR and CBT together will have greater added effects than that seen with either VR or CBT on its own. Additional limitations include variability in patient populations, interventions, and outcome measures. The patient populations of 3 of the studies included 8 different diagnoses, while 1 study had a heterogenic population with unreported diagnoses. This variability in the patient populations makes it difficult to compare the effectiveness of combined VR and CBT across the 4 studies. It may be possible that combined VR and CBT varies in effectiveness depending on the underlying disorder. The variability in the interventions is another limitation. Only 2 of the studies had the same intervention strategy. VR and CBT both have little standardization, which makes it difficult to compare the interventions across the studies. Lastly, the variability of outcome measures makes it difficult to compare the results across the studies. The only outcome measure used by all research groups was the vertigo symptom scale. In summary, the variability in patient populations, interventions, and outcome measures made it difficult to consolidate results and draw valid conclusions. Future research. Further investigation is needed to determine if combined use of VR and CBT is more effective than either VR or CBT on its own. Future study designs need to include larger sample sizes, randomization, control groups, homogeneity of patient population, standardized interventions, and consistent outcome measures. Another issue that needs to be considered is the cost-effectiveness of combining CBT with VR. Traditionally, CBT is an individualized one-on-one treatment. It would be interesting to investigate if CBT administered in groups could be as effective in reducing symptoms and be more cost-effective than individual treatment. To summarize, although combined VR and CBT was found to be an effective intervention for patients with chronic dizziness, we cannot conclude that it is a more effective intervention than either VR or CBT on its own. This review uncovered a shortage of research in the area of VR and CBT and a lack of standardization for both therapeutic methods. Although there is face validity for use of VR and CBT for the treatment of chronic dizziness, stronger evidence that clearly demonstrates the effectiveness of VR and CBT is needed before valid clinical recommendations can be made. These are references. And we would like to thank Dr. Janice Eng, Dr. Susan Harris, and Ms. Charlotte Beck for their help throughout this review. And now we're open for any questions.
Okay, so the question was, we noted the link between the amygdala and the vestibular system. And so the question was, were there any other emotions that were linked to dizziness, such as anger or whatnot?
Oh yeah, or aggression.
Or aggression. From the one of the papers that we read, really the only links that we found were fear and anxiety, which can be different things, but they didn't delve into aggression and whatnot. But it is a reasonable thing to think about and maybe to research further, because when you are anxious or fearful, sometimes that is a defensive response people have. But
Janice?
You talk about there are some trends toward improvements in some of the symptoms. Did you get any sense of how clinically significant these changes were to the patient? Do they talk about how meaningful or subjective or any type of measurement or a way of detecting whether it was meaningful or clinically significant to the patient?
Okay. So the question was, were the results clinically significant, basically? I think, yeah, they were. Most of the outcome measures for measuring dizziness showed improvements, which doesn't necessarily mean clinically, but I think in one of the studies, in some of the studies, people were actually, I don't want to say cured, but weren't experiencing dizziness anymore. And also, some of the outcome measures measured is more their perceived impact of the dizziness on their life, and I think that's huge important, for this sort of situation. And if they don't perceive themselves as this being having adverse effects on them, then I think that quality of life issue is more important than that sort of thing. Does that answer?
You mentioned that it's often a hidden disease, or condition. So how can clinicians be helpful in identifying, if you work with a population that might be at risk, do they give any recommendations of what clinicians should be doing?
Do you mean the clients are at risk, there is kind of hidden that they're not talking about their dizziness or talking about their anxiety, or both?
That they're having dizziness.
And they're not Okay, so the question was to clinicians, for clinicians in identifying patients who might have chronic dizziness and just haven't expressed it. I would say that to be very, I mean, I think as physios, we're trying to be really observant of our clients. And if you notice that they're not moving their head quickly, or that when they do, there's a loss of balance, then you might ask some questions about how they're feeling, and maybe look for key terms like nausea or instability. And so I think looking physically at the client for those physical signs of loss of balance and dizziness, and then asking about how they're feeling, would probably help you identify clients that were feeling dizzy if they're not coming right out and saying it. And in a population like acquired brain injury, where there's a good possibility that dizziness will be part of their diagnosis, to maybe ask some questions around dizziness. Does that sort of answer your question?
So that very first test you got us all to do?
Yes.
Do you think that's a good screener for clinicians to be aware of?
I wasn't thinking of it as a screener. I used it as an example just to show an example of vestibular rehab, but I think that would be a good idea to try something like that, where there was oppositional head and eye movement, and ask if that does provoke dizziness or a sense of nausea. Anybody else? A clinician in the audience could add to that if they like. Okay. Pat.
I was just curious, you said for some future research that you'd like to look and see if cognitive behavioral therapy could be used in like a group setting and compare that to on a one-on-one situation. Is cognitive behavioral therapy done in groups? I mean,
The question was regarding our implication for future research, if CBT or cognitive behavioral therapy can be combined, or if it is usually done individually. Traditionally, it's done on a one-on-one basis with the patient and usually a psychologist. One of the studies, I think, did use a group session for education, and they combined that with CBT, and so I think it would... One of the reasons that is the reason why we would like to investigate it, because doing it on a one-on-one basis is very expensive and sometimes prohibitive, but it might show the best results. It would probably come down to the individual patient, their level of anxiety, their comfort with being with other people or not. But usually, traditionally, it's done one-on-one.
I'd actually just like to add to that. We looked at group cognitive behavioral therapy in terms of cost effectiveness, because obviously one-on-one adding that treatment would be quite costly. And cognitive behavioral therapy is based on this idea of habituation and getting people to feel safe in the environment that makes them anxious. And I actually think that this could be a really good thing to do in a group, because it's like peer, it's like that whole being able to discuss things with your peers who have similar problems to you. So I'd like to see people research that. And I think it could be effective.
I think the quality assessment scale you used really ranked a single subject study very low enough that you rejected it from the review. Was it the description of that scale, was it truly for single subject research designs, do you think? Did it seem to have the items in it that you thought would be appropriate?
The question was the quality assessment appropriate for a single subject? Technically, it's supposed to be able to assess basically any kind of studies design, and that's why we went with it, because we had RCTs and prospective and that sort of thing. So as to whether it really addressed it, I don't know. I don't know. But at the same time, the single subject was just basically, it was one woman. This guy tried some CBT with her because she had dizziness, and it turned out good. Like, that was, it really wasn't all that objective. It wasn't, you know, like it.
Yeah.
So I don't know if that helps.
Yeah. Just looking at the questions, it does seem appropriate to a single study design.
Was it a single subject research design or a case study?
Case study.
I mean, I agree with Lori a bit. When there's limited evidence, which there is in your case, you want to err towards including everything possible. And it might be worth paying that last group to get their case study guidelines and somehow include that, or at least include it in the discussion. I also didn't, did you put levels of evidence up there for the four studies?
Should I take this one or can I? Sure. Susan was asking whether we put levels of evidence, and it's the downs and blocks.
Yeah.
It doesn't offer a cutoff point for levels of evidence, so it leaves it up to the people who use the Downs and Black to discuss, you know, what score out of 32 are we going to say is at what level? We didn't do the Sackett, so is that what you're asking about?
Okay, so, and I don't know the Downs and Black, so embedded within it, you can come up with a level too also?
No, that's kind of a limitation. That is a limitation of the Downs and Black.
Because generally in systematic reviews, and Lori can help me, you want to have two areas: one that looks at methodological rigor, or you know the quality, the rigor of the design, and then second, the quality with which that design was carried out. And it's, I don't think it would be a problem to use both Downs and Black and levels of evidence, because otherwise, I mean, I'm assuming that those randomized controlled trials were both very small numbers, so I'm assuming they wouldn't be a 1B, but probably a 2B or something like that. But that would definitely add to what you've done by having some type of evidence levels as well. And then I add the Holmberg et al. Study you just said was a quasi-experimental design, which isn't really a design description. Is there, can you give me a better design description?
Do you want to?
I'll take this. My group's not going to like this, but I'll take it. The question was, is there a better description than quasi-experimental for the Holmberg? Honestly, I took the red book. I looked through it.
The Courtney
tried to,
Martin's,
yes,
the,
yeah. Courtney and, sorry, whatever.
Courtney
Watkins,
Martin.
Sorry. And just tried to find something that I went through it and tried to identify where it fit best, and that was 4 months ago, and that's the last I know.
Okay.
Yeah.
Can you give me a copy of that? I'll,
I can give it to you right now.
You
can have it.
You can give me five copies right now.
I could add to that. So the I guess why we had chosen quasi-experimental was that Holmberg et al. Looked at a treatment versus two treatments. So there was no control group. So I was looking at VR by itself, self-administered vestibular rehabilitation, and then the other group was vestibular rehabilitation and cognitive behavioral therapy. So there's no control group. They also did not have it was not randomized, because they only did, they basically looked at all the list of subjects. Every second subject was given a cognitive behavioral therapy, and therefore we categorized it as a quasi-experimental study.
Yeah, I think what it is that it's a two-group comparison study without randomization. So I think something more specific could be put around it rather than just quasi-experimental, because that's the thing. But it was fascinating. I mean, clearly there is a need for a lot more research in this area. And it also suggests the interdisciplinariness, because cognitive behavioral therapy is not provided by physical therapists. I'll shut up again. Any of your questions? Must have a code of silence here.
Well, sorry, but before Susan comes up here, we just want to show this again. And yes, Susan, he is still single.
He's still single. Say is,
I had totally forgotten that I asked that, but thank you for sharing it with the whole group. Again, another wonderful presentation on a really, really important topic, and someone who's experienced anxiety-invoked vertigo, fortunately, fairly briefly, I can tell you how important this topic is. So I really, really appreciated it. Look forward to seeing it in press. And I want to keep to our time schedule. I know you'd rather get out early, but there are clinicians that may be coming for certain presentations. So why don't you take a 15-minute break, and we'll start again at 11. Oh, I also want to introduce Lori Roxborough, who helped teach the course. And I don't think we clap for this group, so. I can't remember. I lose count.